from Wentworth Institute of Technology in Boston. Welcome to Inside Wentworth.
Hello, and thanks for joining us. My name is Dennis Nealon, and I'm the host for this episode and the Associate Director for Public Relations and Marketing at Wentworth Institute of Technology. The goal of this podcast series is to share some of the exciting things happening at Wentworth and, more broadly, to highlight the real stuff of higher education, the important courses, programs, people, trends, and events that typically don't get covered in the mainstream media. Today, we're going to be speaking with acclaimed poet Richard Blanco, who in the summer of 2016 was a guest instructor at Wentworth, part of a team of professors offering a new humanities-based course called The Human Engineer. We caught up with him on his way to class to ask him about his work and get his perspective as a poet and a writer on the historic spike in violence in the United States in the summer of 2016. Before we get to our discussion, though, let me share some background with you. Richard Blanco is a civil engineer turned poet who has used his popular writing style to probe the human spirit and explore his Cuban roots. Some of his most recent work has focused on the June 12th mass shooting in a nightclub in Orlando, Florida, a community that Richard knows very well. When he was chosen by President Obama as the fifth inaugural poet in U.S. history, Richard became the youngest person, the first Latino, the first immigrant, and first openly gay person to serve in that role. For that swearing-in ceremony in 2013, Richard composed and recited a work titled One Today, which he discusses with us here today, and which you can find, along with his other works, on Richard's website at richard-blanco.com. Hello, Richard, and thank you for joining us. With your work and your background in mind, tell us what's wrong with our culture today, a culture that in the summer of 2016 was rocked by an unprecedented wave of violence. The question is, how can we attempt to understand what's been going on in our country and put it in some kind of perspective?
Well, getting back to the inaugural poem of One Today, one could say it's optimistic, but it's also, in a way, saying we're not one today. Okay. And the last few lines are sort of acknowledge that hope is waiting for us to map it and waiting for us to name it together. And so, in part, even in that poem, there's a little bit of tension about the idea that, in a sense, the poem is recognizing that we are one today because we all need to function and work together, and we're all interconnected in very significant ways, but that we're not always, we don't always acknowledge that or respect that. So, right. So that's part of the tension in that poem. I think what we're seeing today is, of course, something that what we always see is the tip of the iceberg, is something that goes back in history a long, long way. And I think what we're seeing in a way is the result of several historical variables and, well, just history in general. So one is, of course, our unresolved racism in this country, and extend that racism to, you know, anti-immigration, extend it to anti-ethnic, anti-everything, which is, I think, something that sort of has been building over time for us, something that was not quite resolved. And I think that's part of what's going on. The other piece of that is, for me, is a very broken political system. I think this two-party system that we've had for decades, going back to the Southern Democrats and that whole switcheroony and everything that's happened, and I think, in a way, that's part of what is happening, is that these things, I've been hearing about gun control and gun regulation since I was a kid. I've been hearing about immigration since I was a kid. I've been hearing about the Middle East since I was a kid. And I'm not that young. I'm 48 now. So, you know, I think there's a system that's broken in terms of the politics. And I think what we're seeing is that a broken system can't fix anything. Yeah. And a reluctance to sort of meet at the table. And so what I'm trying to do, what a poet always tries to do and what an artist tries to do, is sort of sort of scratch deeper under the surface than just sort of the expected answers or the expected emotions. And that's what I'm trying to do at some of my work now, is to give it some kind of some kind of historical grounding, some kind of understanding where these problems come from a deeper and a deeper way.
You did some work related to what happened in Orlando. Mm-hmm. Can you describe that and what that entailed?
That poem was obviously what happened in Orlando. It was close to me for several reasons. One, I grew up in Miami, so Orlando is my backyard, and I've been to Orlando been to Disney World about 79 times. So,
79.
So that feels like home. The other thing is most of the, if not all the victims and all the families were Latino. So that also brought it home. And then, of course, being LGBT, which is part of my community. So I felt moved to write a poem. And getting back to sort of your first question in a way, with that poem and a couple others that I've worked on about racism and whatnot, I have been moving in a direction that sort of where the poem becomes much more overt in exposing what's going on and exposing and feeling and being angry. However, I think what a poet, what I try to do in that poem, what I try to do in one today, what I try to do in every poem, whether it's political or about a social justice issue, is that to offer at least a ray of hope, at least a way out. Because if we don't have that, we don't have anything. And if we just continue with hate and hate plus more hate just equals hate and the ping-ponging back and forth, that's going to get anywhere. And I think that's what I'm trying to do with my work, is dig a little deeper and see how we can talk about this in a way that's more than just, you know, lobbing the ball back and just staying in anger or just staying in sorrow. I mean, the last thing we have is hope. And I think if you look at all our spiritual leaders and all our civic leaders, Mahatma Gandhi or Martin Luther King, you realize that they always acted out of love and compassion, with anger, but with love and compassion, with this kind of spiritual kind of confidence, and that people would recognize their humanity in each other. And recognizing one's humanity, I think that's what a poem tries to do, is to turn abstract issues into real faces and names and lives. That opens up a different conversation. And there's not a lot of that kind of talk in our country, and a lot of it is media, and again driven by media and politics, where things are not people, are not people, they're just names, and they're not even names, they're just representational stuff.
True.
You know, and issues just keep on floating and floating and floating. But I think the people of the world, I think the people of the United States can have that conversation. I think it's a little occluded right now, but that's the only way anything has ever really been solved in the history of humanity.
Right.
Is when people talk.
One could argue, I think pretty safely, that art has oftentimes been a catalyst in helping bring the issues, more to the forefront for average people. Now, I'm thinking in terms of sermons, speeches, the written word, the spoken word.
Mm-hmm.
Is that still something that can occur today? Do you think that in the role of art, I'm talking about specifically the role of art, and specifically
sure.
maybe the role of poetry and of writing, can that still, make change, help to bring about change in America?
I think so. I think not necessarily directly in the ways that one might think, but art, again, gives people a different way of thinking about something, gives them a way out, gives them another perspective, gives them a deeper perspective. I certainly hope so. If not, I'm not sure why I would do what I do.
Right. So you have to, you go back again to hope, which is I think what art can
right.
color out, fill in colors
right.
for
right.
us in that respect. What about in terms of teaching? You're working with students at Wentworth now. How does what's going on in the country couple with your work in general, how does that translate into your teaching and then what you're trying to impart on the engineering students here?
Again, a sense of a lack of history, for example, which is just lands us back in the same boat or doesn't let us resolve the issues that we once may have started to resolve, talking specifically about the civil rights movements. I think the humanities in general, people often ask, you know, well, what's the point of the humanities or what's the point of a poem? It's like, well, you're right. There's absolutely nothing practical about art. Unless you consider becoming a more aware, fulfilled human being, practical, then yeah, there's nothing practical. Don't worry about it. and the fact is that a more aware, a more fulfilled, a more educated human being in the ways of humanity will make a better doctor, or lawyer, or engineer, or citizen, or mother, or nurse, or bus driver, or
yeah.
And so I think there's a parallel there. I think part of why a mouth like Trump can say what he says and get away with it is because nobody has a sense of what the real history of what we're talking about. Nobody seems America has an incredible anti-intellectual streak, and it comes from our sort of pioneer and revolutionary spirit, as if to be smart is not important, or you know, it's almost shunned upon. And I think that's part of what happens. I think that's part of what's happening in this country. It's that that we're not valuing, in a sense, what the humanities do for us, from the very name of the whole field of human, to understand who we are and our place in this world, past, present, and future. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I am trying to do in this course, in part to enlighten engineers to realize that my own experience from engineering school was that those things had nothing to do with my job. And the reality is they have everything to do with your job, even on a very practical level.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the humanities.
In terms of the humanities, economics, social sciences, psychology.
Right. So it's not just nuts and bolts and
no,
building
I'm,
something,
right.
Thinking about how do I solve this building.
Not even before it even gets to the solving the building issue.
Yeah.
Sometimes projects, at least in the civil engineering field, sometimes projects will take 3 years of community meetings before you ever start a plan. They're all just concepts and drawings, but it takes a meeting of people and community building. It takes sharing of ideas, team building. It takes understanding regional and local history. It takes understanding the psychology of groups. all these skills that no calculus course is ever going to give you. And not only they're essential to your job, actually, and I would say even more essential than something like calculus, like multivariable calculus. I'm not denying that the sciences and physics and math and all this stuff are not important because they do teach us a way to think. But in general, from what I've seen, the engineering education is lopsided. And not only is it lopsided, but it's also, I think, sending out students in the world without any kind of recognition that this other stuff is not just to cram humanities down their throats so they can be well-rounded individuals. That's poppycock.
Yeah.
There's actually a real reason for this, for you to know this stuff in your job. There's a real application of it in your job. I can give you cite 1,000 examples from my own 20 years as working as an engineer, but you know, that kind of cultural literacy, that kind of understanding how humans work, and understanding that your end user is a human being, and that just because the design is right doesn't mean it's the right design.
Mm-hmm. Almost like there's too much of that same old, that the best thing is success, that all you need to do is succeed, and we seem to, as a culture, focus more on that, that everything's a business, you know, and that you succeed when you, you know, when the black outweighs the red, and you're making money, and that also feeds into this sort of,
feeling that's out there. Anti-intellectualism, so that these things are not important because they're not something you put a dollar sign on or a price tag on. Mm-hmm. And reality is
the most successful engineering firms do. They understand that the most successful projects are the ones that take into account the whole spectrum and panorama of what a design project really involves. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that, again, includes the humanities. But yeah, it's not, there's this sense that that design happens in a vacuum, and and that's it, and it doesn't. And like nothing, like everything else, like every human endeavor, nothing happens in a vacuum. You need at least 12 different disciplines to pull anything off. Mm-hmm. And engineering is no different. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a serious failure of at least recognizing that. I can tell you when the engineering graduates would walk into our office, we would run away from them. Because on the one hand, in a sense, they were taught nothing practical, in the sense of they didn't know how to design anything on the one hand. On the other hand, they could make a phone call or write a letter. So it was like, oh boy, here we have to start the deprogramming here, the reality, be the bearer of bad news and start breaking down what a job in consulting really means. Mm-hmm. And just the idea also, besides all that, that we can... So it's obvious that most of the world's great innovations and innovators have been as a result of synthesis of knowledge of some seemingly disparate pieces of information and of knowledge that suddenly come together in a new way and create something amazing. An obvious example is like the Macs and iPhones,
right,
which are clearly informed by aesthetics, by the humanities, by the sense of interaction between a human being and a machine, and they made the machine more human and sort of, and it's a work of art, right?
Yeah.
It's designed with psychology in mind, mm-hmm, to connect with people in a different way, in a way that seems personal, to the point that it's almost scary. But you could have the same information, you could have the same operating system and the same stuff and just not have that package, and it would just be nothing that exciting. So,
Back to sort of the current state of affairs, if you will. You talk a lot about, or you really, your work seems to reflect a lot of thinking about the human spirit, if we can actually picture what that is. It's a very broad subject, broad meaning, and a personal meaning probably to a lot of people. But is the human spirit now, in what we're seeing in the current events, is the human spirit broken? And what can we do? What should we do to try and fix it?
I can't speak for all of 325 million people, however many in the United States. I think these are tests. I think they're obviously for the people that are most affected. It's even more affecting. This isn't the first time in the history of humanity where someone's spirit has been broken. I believe that humans are incredibly, incredibly resilient people. I think that human beings have an incredible capacities for loss, which is what makes us amazing, and incredible resilience for loss, and an incredible ability to make something good out of it. And I think it's the natural reaction. One cannot stay broken-spirited. That's just not a plausible, healthy place to stay, and most people will not. They have to find some kind of meaning, some kind of hope, some kind of change. I think what we're probably going to see is actually people stop talking a lot of BS and actually doing something, because in that sense, yeah, it's enough. And so, enough pressing like on Facebook, because that really does nothing other than create buzz and whatnot, and does nothing.
commit yourself to something, to some kind of organization, commit yourself to calling a senator or a representative, commit yourself to supporting something, not just with your dollars, but with your mind and your spirit and your energy. And I think that's, I've talked to a couple of people, and that's it. You know, they're tired of talking about this. They're tired of waiting for the politicians to fix it, which they won't. Mm-hmm. They're just, you know, in a sense, nothing, in the very Zen sense, nothing ever is 100% bad or nothing is 100% good. Because out of every bad, something good comes, and out of every good, something bad will happen. So nothing's perfect. Right. So I think, you know, in some senses, we're going through an incredible sort of inventory in this country of who we are. And you can just sort of see in the polar spectrum of a candidate like Bernie Sanders and a candidate like Donald Trump. That says a lot. That says a lot about how confused we are, how much we need to sort of get grounded back into what this country and decide as a people, what are we and what do we stand for, and what does that mean? And I mean, I'm sorry to say, but I think it'll probably get worse before it gets better. I think the time is right for some kind of counterculture or cultural revolution, because it's really getting polarized, and it's really a break, almost the beginning of a breaking point, I would hope. Yeah. I think, you know, we've got to get over this hurdle and decide who we are as a country, and if we're really going to live up to those, going to pursue those ideals as they are written, not interpreted as they are written in the Constitution.
Thanks for listening to Inside Wentworth. To learn more about Wentworth and read our latest news and feature stories, visit us online at www.wit.edu.